Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and welcome to a special one-hour broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio. Many talented writers make their home in Duluth Superior and the Shawamigan Bay area. Up next, we feature original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 9th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organizes a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 18 writers read their stories and poems on the theme of encounters. The public reading was held on Friday, January 25th, 2019, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. We begin our program with the event's MC and Northland College English professor Cynthia Belmont reading a few words from U.S. poet laureate Tracy K. Smith.
She wrote a famous poem that is all about encounters called My God, It's Full of Stars. And it's about space and vision and seeing. And here's a quote from it. Sometimes what I see is a library in a rural community. All the tall shelves in the big open room. And the pencils in a cup at circulation, gnawed on by the entire population. The books have lived here all along, belonging for weeks at a time to one or another in the brief sequence of family names. Speaking, at night mostly, to a face, a pair of eyes, the most remarkable lies. And this long poem ends by her talking about when the Hubble telescope first started working and the pictures started coming back from deep space, and it was incredible. And she says, "We saw to the edge of all there is, so brutal and alive, it seemed to comprehend us back." Encounters.
Hello, I'm Kyle Lanthold. I go to college here at Northland, and I'll be reading poetry tonight, but first I wanted to say something. And I think I can speak for a lot of students here in saying that college is weird. You do a lot of learning here, and there's a couple things that I've learned. One is that the heart wants what the heart wants, and sometimes the swing goes both ways. So without further ado, here's my poem, Caravaggio's Bacchus as a candlelit dinner for two. He lies there against a pile of satin pillows, welcoming me in with no words, just his stare and a goblet of rich wine that he twirls with his delicate fingers, swirling up the aromas of apple and apricot, amid a lake of red grape, a siren of the sea calling out to me, his flushed face, a mask of drunken joy, smirks through the shadows of a flickering candle, and his eyes, the flame of desire spreads to my own, soaking in awe at his muscles sculpted by Jupiter's bolt and gentle mouth grown by Ceres' touch. This night will end, one way or another, and all the wine will be gone. The only question is, will he incite the inferno, or will I?
I'm Sue Schreiner, and I'm from Washburn, and I will be reading a nonfiction piece titled Super Sue. I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2011. This led to encounters that I normally would not have had. With this experience also evolved my alter ego, Super Sue. Most people know me as a competent, mild-mannered public servant who has survived her share of verbal attacks by frustrated, angry, or scared people. In my role as a school counselor, my response has always been to suck it up and excuse their behavior, hoping I help them resolve their issues. These interactions contribute to the creation Super Sue. I would replay stressful interactions in my mind thinking, what would Super Sue do? Act defenseless? Never. I needed to call on Super Sue during my breast cancer saga more than once. After the initial screenings, I was sent to a dungeon-like place called the Breast Center for a biopsy. I sat scared in my hospital gown in a windowless, dimly lit waiting room. Finally, my name was called and I went to a room for a manual breast exam. Now one would think that the nurses at a breast center would be kind, caring, and empathetic. Not in this case. As the exam started, Nurse Nasty, if she even was a nurse, discovered an odd spot under my left breast. I happen to be one of approximately 2 to 6% of women with an extra nipple. Lucky me. Not something I tout, because it is a bit embarrassing. Nurse Nasty found it so interesting that she blurted out in the most accusing voice, "What's that, a pimple?" As if I had purposefully installed that extra nipple just to annoy. Already mute with fear from the upcoming biopsy, all I could manage was a meek reply, "No." The professionals in the next dimly lit room were indeed kind, caring, and empathetic. They reported that, one, I did have a lump, two, it had tentacles sprouting out of it, three, there was also a lump in my right lymph node, and four, it all looked so ugly that it needed to be removed, even if it wasn't cancerous. They could detect my fear and told me to have Nurse Nasty schedule a surgical consultation. Now that sounded simple enough, except Nurse Nasty fought me every step of the way. You can't make an appointment with a surgeon until your biopsy results come in. 80% of all lumps are benign. I told her that the person doing the biopsy said for me to get it set up. "Well, I'll have to see about that," she said. What would Super Sue have done? In her tights and cape and the Super Sue emblem on her chest, Super Sue would have confronted the situation with a strong, calm, firm yet helpful approach. "Excuse me, I'm Super Sue, and I'm here to help you. With my counselor training, I know about matching people and careers. It seems that you have selected nursing as your path. But the breast center isn't a good fit for you." Poof, you are now working on autopsies in the morgue. So you can't spread your misery to any other worried potential breast cancer patients. And the world will be a better place. The next encounter happened a few weeks later. Because I couldn't bear ever having another mammogram in my life, I had chosen to have a double mastectomy, plus extra nippleectomy. I was also trying to do everything I could to put breast cancer behind me forever. With my surgeries, they implanted ingenious drainage systems that included bulbs with tubes embedded into the wounds that drew out any fluid buildup to help in healing and to prevent infection. Each day, you record the amount of fluid that had drained into each bulb, and when it gets to a certain level, you can have the apparatus removed. Finally, the day arrived to get the first one taken out by a highly qualified nurse practitioner, an APRN-CNP. I was super excited. I entered the exam room and the nurse practitioner pulled out the never-ending tube. It felt amazing. She then said that my post-surgical report was available, so I asked about the results. "Am I going to be able to grow old?" I asked, nervously. Debbie Downer's reply, "Well, breast cancer is a gift that keeps on giving." That was totally unexpected and not what I wanted to hear. The sound of those words have stayed with me, despite them being refuted by my awesome oncologist. What would Super Sue have done? Donning her tights and cape with the Super Sue emblem on her chest, Super Sue would have confronted the situation with a calm, strong, firm yet helpful approach. "Excuse me, I'm Super Sue, and I'm here to help you. With my counselor training, I know about matching people and careers. Seems that you have selected nursing as your path, but working with cancer patients and vulnerable people doesn't seem to be a good fit." Poof! We have now put bright red warning labels, like the ones on patient records warning of allergies, on your chart. And the world will be a better place.
My name is Gina Kirsten, and I'm from Washburn and Northland College. And this is nonfiction, and this was my encounter. When I was in college, I worked at a backpacking camp and somehow understood on a very deep cosmic level that I was the physical incarnation of the marriage between Mother Nature and St. Francis of Assisi. I cultivated this image by hiking in long, gauzy skirts and pointing out that birds landed on branches very near my head and squirrels dashed very near my feet, but no one noticed but me. One night, as we gathered around the campfire to listen to the harmonies of guitar and crackling wood, I knew my moment of recognition had come. I spied her as she headed out of the woods, a sweet doe, and our eyes met in the most meaningful way. She did not dash away, but seemed to edge slowly closer to our group. She did not take her eyes from mine, and I blinked and nodded reassurance to her. She responded to my universally calming gesture by walking confidently right into our fire ring, with our eyes never losing contact. Everyone fell silent in wonder as she walked purposefully, stopping right in front of me. Our eyes locked, and we looked deeply into the windows of each other's souls. The doe and I held each other's gaze for what seemed like a sufficient amount of time to reveal my true nature to my fellow campers. We each took in a deep breath, paused, dwelling in the reverence of this profound moment, and then she snorted black snot all over my face. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Ella Shively, and I'm back with a piece of fiction called Schrodinger's Cat. The two almost strangers squared off 50 feet above the ground on a dormitory balcony, a drunk college boy named Javier and a girl named Jackie who had seen him climb onto the railing. Until this moment, their only connection had been a few hellos and the occasional flirtatious complaint about their physics class. "Javier, please come down," said Jackie. Javier shook his head vigorously. "No, no, I like it up here. I'm Schrodinger's cat up here. Until I climb back down or fall over the edge, I'm both dead and alive at the same time. I'm alive and I'm dead. Isn't that crazy?" "Then by that logic, until you confirm or deny what I'm about to suggest, you are in love with me, and you're not. But I'd say that you are," said the girl. Javier balanced flamingo-like on the railing and stared at her hard. How had he never noticed those eyes before? They were sharp behind her narrow glasses, the irises almost completely black. God, he'd never known how much he loved dark eyes. He felt as if he were gazing into a clear night sky, and past the sky, into the undiscovered nooks and crannies of the universe. Brilliant, blinding supernovas burst at the edge of his vision. It was dizzying. She was dizzying. "Jackie," he whispered. "That's it. Come on down." She was reaching up, though towards what? He wasn't sure. Him, or the stars, or maybe Newton's apple, he didn't know, but he reached for her anyway. The planets tilted on their axes, and her universe eyes filled up the whole sky until everything was black and full of stars. She was speaking to him, and her voice was the siren call of gravity. That was when he fell. Oh, he fell for her hard.
You've been listening to Writers Read, Encounters, a collection of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry read by writers before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 9th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organizes a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 18 writers read their stories and poems on the theme of encounters. The public reading was held on Friday, January 25th, 2019, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their writings for Writers Read, Encounters.
Hello, my name is Carol Dunbar, and this is the fourth time I've had the privilege of attending Writers Read. I hail to you from Superior, Wisconsin, and I will be reading a piece of nonfiction tonight called Mother Bear. 14 years ago, my husband and I moved off the grid. We are independent when it comes to our heat, water, and electricity. We have raised two children with no microwave or clothes dryer, endured summers without AC, winters without hot water. And yet, I struggle less with what we live without and more with who we live with. The skunks, the snakes, the spiders, the bugs. I never used to think much about the environment until it started getting in my way. And then, 12 years ago, as I pushed my two children in my double jogger stroller, a mother bear lumbered out from the woods. She came from my right and crossed the road not 10 feet in front of me, her padded feet the size of dinner plates. I stopped behind my stroller, my two children, ages 3 and 3 weeks, inside sleeping. Then, again from my right, two cubs tumbled out into view, sensed my presence, and plunged back into the foliage. The mother bear from the edge of the road turned, sniffed, and rose on hind legs to her full height. The sight of her magnificence sent me sinking to my knees. Not 3 days earlier, I had called the DNR and asked them what to do about the bears plundering our bird feeder. "Black bears are nothing to worry about," he said. "The only time they're dangerous is if you get between a mother and her cubs. Whatever you do, do not do that." We were all in a fairly straight line. The mother bear to my left, the cubs to my right, and me with my sleeping children in the middle. I had given birth not 20 days prior to my son, who is not much bigger than a bread loaf, sleeping next to his sister. It was spring, and this bear had also just given birth. The moment sharpest in my mind is when we made eye contact. It was like finding a stranger across a crowded room who shared your exact experience and reaction, so the connection was instant. She wasn't just a bear. She was a mother who knew I had my young with me, just as I knew about hers. And she didn't like the situation one bit more than I did. Her eyes glinted like flints, and she grunted, but she did not move. Instead of a complete freak out, a sane and tempered reasonableness rose through me, what I am sometimes capable of when at my best. I saw that our stillness was our only way of communicating. And so it seems to me that we agreed, as mothers, not to move. We kept vigil. That bear stood at the edge of the road, and I crouched behind my baby stroller. Over and over, the cubs came out, squeaked, and high-tailed it back into the brush. Once a cub pushed its sibling out onto the road, the bear found its feet with frantic indignation and scampered back where a noisy tussle ensued. I don't know how long I stood out on that road. It felt like 20 minutes. Maybe it was 10. Finally, a car came along and the mother bear ducked away. I saw my chance. Using the car like a shield, I sprinted with my stroller home. I never saw those bears again. Our encounter could have ended any number of ways had that mother bear and I not struck an agreement that day, an agreement that, for my part, I am still trying to uphold. I no longer assume that what the beaver, the bat, or even an ant is doing isn't just as important as what I am doing. I feel a deep sense of loyalty to my environment now, not just because I want to save it, but because I think it just might save me. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Grace Kilbane, and I'm living in Duluth. And today I have something I wrote for you to read. It was 3 a.m., and I had just returned from the emergency room. I was late for my overnight shift, which had started earlier that day, or technically the day before, because on third shift, days and nights get confused. The schedule messes with your equilibrium. Dreams and reality are jumbled, and thoughts can drift from certainty. I got a call from an old coworker who was concerned about Sam. I listened, I said the appropriate words, and I hung up. I didn't work there anymore, and it really wasn't my problem, right? Wrong. As much as I tried to ignore that feeling sneaking up from my gut to my chest, I couldn't. So I decided to call him. Hello. Hi, is this Sam? Yes. Hi, this is Grace. Hi. Hey, so I was just calling to see how you were doing. Not good. Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Did you need to talk about it? Yes. I didn't know him very well. I worked part-time with him for a few years. That was a few years ago. And frankly, I always thought he was a little strange and callous towards other people. An odd bird, as they say. But something called me to act, so I agreed to meet with him. So I explained to my boyfriend at the time not to be too concerned, but to be a little concerned. We agreed on a check-in time, and I would call him. If he didn't hear from me, he was to contact the cops and make sure I wasn't being chopped up and fed to the fish. In such a scenario, then I would do my best to leave clues from the location, which is, of course, ridiculous. But it seemed fine in the days before the Craigslist killer and GPS tracking. So a half hour later, I pulled up outside Sam's house, and he got in the car, looking awful and stinking of some kind of funk. It was like a mix of booze, sweat, just overall dishevelment. I guess he was in his mid-30s, but his face was pale and drawn, and he had a twitchy look to him. At the cafe, I ordered a sandwich, and he ordered breakfast. His speech was haunted and halting. I remember trying to make sense of his thoughts, which were cavernous, barren. I was lost. He glanced at the water, grasped it, and his tremor was immediately clear. I pretended not to notice, but I was taking an internal inventory of any time I had ever seen the shakes, which was never. He took a few bites and started sweating, and then excused himself to the bathroom. Oh, a bad hangover, I thought. But when he returned, he looked like he was dying, and he agreed to let me take him to the hospital. So on the way to the ER, he smoked a cigarette, and the hole in my upholstery would haunt me for years. When we got there, he filled out his paperwork, and I stood there awkwardly. They took him in and gave him an IV and rehydrated him like it was no big deal. The secretary then called his emergency contact, which was his ex-girlfriend, and gave me the phone. The most uncomfortable conversation I have ever been involved with then ensued, and she said, "I'm done. I cannot do this anymore." "Okay," I said, and I hung up the phone. I get that. I really do. I just was not expecting it. But I wasn't really expecting any of this. It was absolutely shocking to me that his friends, his family, his most beloved person on the planet had all just thrown him away to the side, not to be bothered with any longer. I mean, how badly does a person have to screw up to be this alienated? I didn't know. I still don't know. I think about it all the time in this era of online connections and social media and connecting without really connecting. How many others? He was hydrated and feeling better, so they released him pretty quickly. I wish I had asked for a psych consult, but I didn't even know what that was at the time. I wish somebody had asked me what I was doing there with him. I didn't know. They didn't know. He probably didn't even know. I took him home and asked him if there was any alcohol left in the house, and he said no, he'd drank it all. I did not go in. I watched him close the door behind him, and then I drove promptly to the liquor store for a six-pack. According to the obituary, he died at home. It could have happened a million ways, but it didn't. I know exactly how it happened, and the obituary was sufficiently vague. I wish that I could have saved him. I wonder why he let me in that day. I barely knew him. I wonder why I did not do more that day. I barely knew him. But I knew enough to know that it was a bad situation, but it was someone else's bad situation, I thought. And that thought stays with me. At what point does someone else's bad situation become our own? I've always been terrible at boundaries, and I've had my share of bad situations. I may not have been able to save him, but I can save myself. So I put the six-pack back in the fridge, and I go to work, where it's already halfway through the night or the day or whatever it is. Because third shift is a real mind and you're never really sure if you are awake or if you are asleep.
How's it going, everybody? My name's Sean Devlin. Just recently moved to Washburn, and I got a pretty quick poem for you. It's called A Moment After Midnight. In a moment after midnight, when moonlight shaved the corner of an open drawer, I was desperate for a homecoming and saw you, after love, bent at the waist, rummaging clothes behind you, then pulling the gray, white-striped sweatshirt over pale skin. You turned to leap into dark sheets, your hair brown caught silver, as the shave lifted up the wall and a cloud told darkness in the room and you waned like a wish. Thanks.
You've been listening to Writers Read, Encounters, a collection of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry read by writers before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're featuring original works of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 9th annual Writers Read event. Each year, a group of writers organizes a public reading of the best submissions from talent living throughout the region. This year, 18 writers read their stories and poems on the theme of encounters. The public reading was held on Friday, January 25th, 2019, before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their writings for Writers Read, Encounters.
My name is Lori Otis, and I'm from Washburn. And I'd like to read you my story called The Wedding House. It's about encountering nature in the wilds of Wisconsin. My daughter and I sat in the dining room, by the dining room table, with our backs to the window. It was January, and one of the month's frequent snowstorms was driving sleet against the windows in sort of an even tapping cadence. But we were making plans for a hot day towards the end of July, some 6 months away. We would be attending her son's, my grandson's, wedding, an outdoor affair in Wisconsin's inland lake country. Here's what I wanted to talk to you about. She sounded as if she needed to convince me of something. I tensed, as you do when you fear you may be blindsided. We've decided to rent a house close to the wedding venue for a week, just before the actual date. Oh, we found a great Airbnb next to the lake, and it's got canoes and paddleboard, a pontoon boat, and it sleeps 12 people. It has a full kitchen and indoor hot tub. Doesn't it sound great? Who would this 12 be? I asked uncertainly. Well, we three from Wisconsin, from northern Wisconsin, Laura Bow and boys, her daughter, my granddaughter, maybe Bow's brothers and their boys, or, well, anybody who needs a place to stay for the wedding. It sounded too magnanimous to me. but given our current political atmosphere, my mind immediately formed a picture of a determined caravan of wedding guests wending its way north to our wedding house, their feet following the cadence of the blowing snow. What about this full kitchen? I knew from experience that caravans of people need food, and full implies meals, not a sandwich or a hot dog. Well, I thought that you and I could make a few things ahead, like lasagna and chili, and we'll go out for burgers a lot. Maybe you'd like to make a roaster of your homemade baked beans. Your beans are so good. A little flattery never hurts, and it always works with me. I was immediately on board, and as the snow tapped at the windows, we spent the afternoon making lists and finding recipes. You know, my daughter said, our little boys are city boys from the heart of Chicago, and I want to give them a real North Wisconsin experience so they'll look forward to visiting. Well, eventually the snowstorms ceased, and the grass and the leaves grew green. The months rolled by quickly, and I found myself packed in the car amidst swimsuits, swim vests, containers of food, cartons of juice boxes, and first aid kits, to name only a few of the items wedged against me in the back seat. It was a pleasant day for a drive in the beautiful Wisconsin countryside, and our pleasure continued when we drove into the driveway of our home for the coming next week. It was a grand old house built in the early 20s for a large family. Our exploring occupied the afternoon. Our first opportunity to introduce our northern nature came that night at twilight when a doe deer and her fawn still had some spots walked through the yard on their way to the lake. We stood silently on the porch as they drank and then walked off into the woods. What a gentle, what a meaningful minutes. The first encounter backfired, however, when the next morning we told the kids, you don't have to wait for somebody to take you to the park. It's a big yard. Go out and play. I'm not going out there alone, the oldest said. Those big deer might come back. Well, no amount of explanation or reassurance could convince them. And I thought as a child, and I wondered how eager I'd be to play in an area where animals three times my size roamed. Our permission seemed almost like we're saying to our precious little boys, go play in traffic. Later that day, we introduced them to the swimming in the lake. Now, they all swam. They had pools and water parks. It was a part of their culture. But they looked down from the dock, and they saw water weeds waving sinuously like snakes under the surface. And occasionally, a fish would swim by. The depths were deep and dark. I don't want to swim with the fishes, was the nodded consensus. The eldest seemed to speak sonorously in a voice reminiscent to me of the Godfather. It was a long first day at the wedding house. At twilight, we stood on the dock to watch the sunset, and somebody noticed that there were fish swimming around in shallow water near the shore, and they were feeding on the insects that were floating on top of the water. Then my granddaughter approached her son with hands cupped. She slowly removed the top hand to reveal a tiny tree frog, no bigger than her little fingernail. Do you want to hold him? She asked her son, who reluctantly allowed the transfer and stood stiffly. The other boys gathered around to admire the tiny feet. I think he likes you, Mother encouraged. And indeed, it seemed as if the frog had nested contentedly among the warm folds of that little palm. And the boy relaxed, and he looked deeply into those bulging little eyes. And he said, "I think he loves me. I'm going to name him Froggy." Well, at that exact moment, Froggy made the worst decision of his minute life. He flexed his hind legs, leaped into the air, and spiraled out over the water, where one of the feeding fish rose to the surface and gulped him down like a tasty morsel. I swear, it all happened in slow motion. Oh, the shock and horror on everyone's face. As with every tragedy, there's the crying, the denial, the anger, and finally the acceptance. It was a somber bedtime when the comforting mothers tucked their little ones in and an elected father took his turn at the bedside. I don't envy him as he calmly began to explain nature to the inquiring minds. Maybe I was wondering how to sell the boys on all the hamburgers and the patties and the hot dogs and the chicken nuggets in the big commercial refrigerator in that full kitchen. Or maybe I was relieved that what they would no longer eat would accommodate the wedding caravan. What I secretly hoped was that Dad would save the explanation of nature's food chain and our part in it until they were older. And so the week wore on with joy and disappointment in equal abundance, a lot like life, but compressed into the wedding week. The caravan arrived, ate, and danced at the reception. We didn't go out for burgers once. And although sorely pressed at times, we were all still speaking by the time the beautiful bride walked down the grassy meadow to the flower-bedecked arbor in front of the apple orchard. Well, now it's January again, and one of the month's frequent snowstorms is blowing sleet against the window next to my chair in sort of a tapping cadence. I slowly drift with the cadence into a sweet sleep, and I dream of soft summer nights, the lake at sunset, and even of the hapless Froggy, who perhaps taught the little boys the most important lesson of the wedding week, which they will come to remember and understand as they grow older. Whether in Chicago or North Wisconsin, life is fleeting. Make the most of it. Thank you.
And lastly, in this hour, we bring you a story by writer Julie Buckles.
Hi, everyone. So I'm the director of communications here at Northland College, which means one part of my job is social media. I create content for it. I monitor it. I bathe in it. I'm all social media all day long. And so one morning about 2 years ago, at the beginning of December, so it was December 2015, I was scrolling and there was a video that caught my eye, and it's 4 minutes long, which is like a century in social media time, but I stopped to watch it with sound. And the reason I stopped to watch it was because it was directed by Wes Anderson. And I'm a big fan of Wes Anderson. He's known for his specialized color and dialogue. And actually, I'm gonna do a little bit of audience participation here. I'm going to read off his films, and I want you to raise your hand if you've seen it. And we're going to start from his most recent film and work our way back. Isle of Dog. Moonrise Kingdom. I know a lot of you have seen that one. The Grand Budapest Hotel. The Darjeeling Limited. Life Aquatic. The Royal Tenenbaums. Rushmore. And now we're going to find out the true fans. Bottle Rocket. All right. So you know who he is. And because I'm in marketing, What I saw when I saw this film was beautiful, heartwarming social media gold. It's about a little boy who's on a train. It's done for a company named H&M or H&H, I'm not sure which. But it's a little boy who's on a train, and suddenly the train is delayed. And it's Christmas time, and so the people on the train all come together, and they create a surprise for this little boy, so he experiences Christmas. And it's and it involves some of Wes Anderson's actors that he likes to use. And it's really fun. I just watched it again the other day, and I love it. So I sent a link to my marketing coworkers at Northland, and then I pitched my idea. We would do the same thing, but without budget, actors, time, or proper equipment. The plan, we would tell our then college president, Michael Miller, a distinguished, intelligent, but good-humored man, that we were making a simple holiday film, and we would capture him walking from his house on campus, across campus, saying hello to people, and then he would sit at his desk, and he would say, "Happy holidays." That's what we told him. Meanwhile, we planned for our Wes Anderson twist. A volunteer crew of staff and students would invade his office and decorate. We would walk in and we'd catch the surprise on film. In the next few days, we shaped the script. We asked David Mateel, who has 17 decorated Christmas trees in his spectacular Victorian house, to take charge of the decorations. My student worker, a social media magic maker named Michaela, arranged for students to ride by on a bicycle carrying compost and wave. She asked the guy on the slack line if he would appear at a certain time. And in other words, we wanted youthful, Northland-like things to happen to President Miller as he walked across campus. We had one more secret surprise, a reindeer suit that had originated from the now-closed downtown JCPenney's. It had been given to an employee who passed it on to her daughter, who passed it on to David. We wanted the reindeer to spring across campus for the movie. Michaela recruited a tall soccer player who didn't have class at that time. He would also help decorate the office. The reindeer became the thread that would pull this narrative together. And the dramatic arc would be his race to get to the office to decorate it before President Miller arrived. On the morning of the shoot, snow fell. The snow came out for the first time in weeks, and at precisely 9 a.m., Michaela met the president at his house as scheduled. Perfect. Photographer Bob and David left for the president's office. I told them they had 1 hour. The soccer player, tall and athletic, appeared ready for his fitting. The reindeer suit had an enormous mask with a foam liner that allows sight through the mouth, so it's like the nose is up here. The immediate problem was that the nose was drooping, so his field of vision was slim. And we were trying to fix that, but while we were fixing it, I looked out my window, and I could see that President Miller and Michaela were already crossing the street. It was 9:02. So I told Rudolph we needed to move. I needed to get to the office with the third camera to capture the surprised reaction. Rudolph and I trotted over to Wheeler Hall, and we peeked around the corner to spy the action. President Miller, you could see, thought of this as a task to be performed, and he was clipping along as fast as he could go, and I could see Michaela was trying to slow him down, ask him questions, reshoot. She even did one thing where she looked deep in thought, and it was not really working. He was still clipping along. So I gave Rudolph a shove, and I told him to fly. He passed behind President Miller, who caught a quick glance of him out of the side of his eye. Michaela ran interference by asking President Miller a question. I then realized I needed to cut in front of President Miller in order to get to the office with the camera, plus I needed to warn the crew that he was really early. I dropped my box of tree decorations and took off on a run after the reindeer who had disappeared into the building. I'm not sure what was more surprising to President Miller, the reindeer or me. If I had had a moment of composure, I would have stopped, said good morning, asked how the shoot was going, but fight or flight had kicked in and I was in flight. I threw up my hand in a half wave as I sprinted in my work skirt and boots past the two of them. I galloped up the steps and to the room to warn everyone. It was 9:20. The office was only partially decorated. The crew scrambled. The reindeer pranced. I turned around toward the door and screamed! There, through the vertical narrow window, stood the president in his long black wool coat and scarf. How did he move so quickly? I slammed my body against that window. He's here, I announced, stating the very obvious. Everyone filed out of his back door into this conference room that's in the back that connects. I realized at that moment I hadn't instructed them that they were supposed to stay and say surprise. So I called them back while I stood like this and told them to yell happy holidays when he walked in. I then unpeeled my body from the window and allowed the president of our college through his own office door, somewhat baffled but full of good cheer. The video was not Wes Anderson. But it wasn't bad either. There's a lot you can do with editing. It certainly made all of us laugh. It's called Holiday Surprise, and you can find it on the Northland College YouTube channel. Thank you.
You've been listening to Writers Read Encounters, a collection of fiction, nonfiction, and poetry read by writers before a live audience. The event is produced by Northland College in Ashland in collaboration with Wisconsin Public Radio. Many thanks to our partners, the judges and writers Kyle Anholt, Dylan Couch, Sean Devlin, Carol Dunbar, Crystal Gibbons, Joel Glickman, Riley Kaiser, Grace Kilbane, Angie Mason, Lori Otis, Sheila Packa, Sue Schreiner, Ella Shively, J.W. Sutton, Tara Wisniewski-Janish, Devin Levy, Gina Kirsten, and Julie Buckles. I'm Danielle Kading. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.